You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the 10th voice. The views and opinions of this program are those of its hosts and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
This is the 10th Voice, Kansas City's gay and lesbian radio magazine. The 10th Voice, because you refuse to be silent.
This is the Sandra Moran Radio Book Club. It's every second Saturday on the 10th Voice, KKFI's public affairs show for the LGBT community. And now I want to welcome our guest to the show. We, of course, have our producer and sound engineer, Linda Wilson, here. Hi, Linda.
Good afternoon. Good to be here.
And I'm joined in the studio by Rashawn Gilmore.
Hi, Elizabeth. I'm so glad to be back. This is starting to feel like home.
And Kent Kozat, I just met 2 weeks ago in New York City. Kent, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Wonderful. And Eric Peterson, I have not talked to you yet, but I believe you're also on the East Coast.
I am. I'm in Washington, D.C. It's good to meet you, even over the phone.
And it's a small world. I met Rashawn on the 10th Voice at least 3 years ago, probably longer.
Yes, it's about that. Yeah, a little over 3 years ago.
When he was a guest. Kent, I became aware of through our mutual friend and my fellow host, Philip Blue Owl Hooser, and I met Eric online through Stephanie Duell and also Faye Jacobs. So it's a great panel, and I'm looking forward to discussing Charles M. Blow's Fire Shut Up in My Bones. First, though, so we get to know a little bit about the panelists, I would like to ask each one of you about a literary influence or multiple influences that helps shape you. And I'll start with you, Kent.
Thanks. Literary influence would probably have to be Charles Dickens. He came first to mind. And once you start thinking about it, of course, there's so many. But I am sticking with Dickens because the scope of his novels is always so huge. And there's so many, such a vast canvas of characters. And they're books that are devoted to pointing out the social injustice that was, you know, systemic in Victorian society. And he never shook that devotion to that, almost no matter what he wrote. So that was a huge influence. And you also asked about theater influences in your message this morning. And I would just toss out Sam Shepard is probably the one that hit me the strongest and hardest once I came to know his plays. And I loved it that he can take a small situation, 24 hours in a Illinois farmhouse, and it becomes an epic experience. So those are my two.
And Eric, how about you?
When you asked me that earlier today, I originally kind of went back to my early writing as well, and I used to do, you know, most of my writing for the theater. And so if I had to pick the ones that really kind of grabbed me, they would probably be Edward Albee. And I thought of Anton Chekhov, who I've never actually read in the original Russian. I don't speak Russian. But all the works that I've seen of his, you know, really did kind of move me. And what I love about both of them is how, especially Chekhov, is able to write about people talking about the weather. And, of course, they're never talking about the weather. You know, usually it's been set up that one of them is desperately in love with the other and wants to propose, rather than doing so is talking about the weather. And in the moment of talking about the snowfall, we're just introduced to this huge amount of heartbreak. And whenever a writer can do that, can talk about one thing while really kind of pulling your emotions in a completely different direction, I'm always very drawn to that. And if I had to pick another, kind of on the other side of the spectrum, I'd have to say, and I think about her a lot because she's passed away just so recently, is Carrie Fisher. You know, wonderful actress, but brilliant writer. Love all of her work, and was first really taken with her with Postcards from the Edge, which still, the original novel, I think about all the time, and really admire a lot of the stuff that she did there.
Those are thoughtful answers. I'm going to throw it to Rashawn now.
Well, this will probably come as no great surprise to Elizabeth or any of the listeners who have joined me on this broadcast before, but the two that popped instantly in my head were James Baldwin and Toni Morrison. And I think both writers write from a different perspective about the same issue. issue, but they have these overlapping or intersectional components as well. So whereas the central theme might be race itself, you have Baldwin coming at it also from the perspective of being a gay man, and an out openly gay man, black gay man, at a time when that wasn't exactly the most, I don't know, he was definitely very progressive for the time. And then you have Morrison, who as a woman, and how she approaches the subject as well. And so I cannot think of two more profound and prolific writers than those two on that subject. And for me, it's very present. I talk about it a lot on my Facebook page. And of course, it's a factor in the subject matter that we're discussing today, the author that we're discussing today. So I think those two for me, and they just have a way, especially Baldwin, with drawing you in and forcing you to confront yourself. And with such authenticity and with such powerful imagery that you just cannot deny it. And I guess the same may be true instead of Morrison, too. So those two are probably my absolute favorites, and I'm rereading all of their works right now. So that's quite an assignment.
I found something interesting in something each of you said. Kent mentioned Dickens, and I was talking about Bleak House and Jarndyce versus Jarndyce with a friend just recently. And it's true. Dickens is still very relevant, even though it's Victorian. I agree with you, Kent. When you were talking about playwrights, Eric, I mentioned in a message this morning that I thought of one of the first plays that really hit me because the playwright was such a wordsmith, and that was Tom Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, and I thought, wow, I want to do that with words. James Baldwin, when I read about his knowledge of Italy and how even though he didn't look as if he belonged, he explored the culture, he explored the language, and there are so many Americans, even today, who don't do that, who see no need to have a passport, who see, and he was a man of the world.
Truly.
So, and I want to mention here as we slide into the book that in interviews, Charles M. Blow had cited his literary fathers as James Baldwin, Langston Hughes, and Ernest Gaines. For women literary mothers, he cited Toni Morrison, Alice Walker, and Maya Angelou. And I saw a review by a young Chicana woman who said, as a Chicana Mexican-American woman who grew up in poverty in Southern California, my experiences resonate with those of a black man who grew up in poverty in Louisiana, and that is the mark of truly breadth-reaching and breathtaking writing. I want to ask here just a general question. What first struck you when you had finished the book about Charles's writing, and what did it leave you with, the overall impression? Rashawn, I'll start with you.
What I appreciated most and what had the most sort of gravity with me was his authenticity. And you see that from the very beginning, this journey that he's on, and how well he sort of picks you up and takes you on that journey with him. There's no point in the book where you, at least for me anyway, and I'm a black gay man, so maybe that heightens it, but I think for any reader, like the reviewer you just read from the Chicana lady was saying, that you feel like you can relate. Like, I felt like I was reading from stories from my own life or experience. And so for me, the fact that he was so patently transparent, I felt like he left nothing out. And I've read books and even memoirs where you feel like, okay, but what's next? What's the next chapter? This felt like a complete work to me up to this point of his life.
And I've read memoirs where it's, what did you leave out? There's something missing here.
Exactly.
And
he didn't do that. Yeah.
Kent, what about you?
Well, to me, the really remarkable thing about the book is how beautifully he's able to describe the experience of being a child with a relatively, what we know with hindsight to be a relatively small world, and how vast that feels to the child. You know, it's just family, and that's an entire universe. And that he's able to move us through that experience of childhood into adolescence and early adulthood, I think is really remarkable. It just stuns me.
Eric?
I have to say, I had two very different reactions when I finished reading the book, and one is really about Charles Blow, and the other one is probably just more about me. The first one was that, you know, I really kind of thought, this is a journalist. You know, he's mostly a kind of op-ed columnist, and he did a lot of visual work, but he writes very much like a journalist, and that he doesn't embellish a lot. He really just lets the power of the story do the work for him, and it really felt like a lot of times he was just reporting the facts, even if his facts were, you know, kind of a severing between body and spirit, which is not a topic that most journalists will cover necessarily. But he really just kind of stuck to didn't, you know, there was not a lot of embellishment. It wasn't dressed up. And I never felt as though I was being manipulated emotionally so much as I just felt very lucky to be on the other end of this story. The other one was really, you know, I know that we're kind of, you had mentioned, Elizabeth, in some of your promos for this particular show that we're, you know, this time we're addressing the B in LGBT. And I noticed that I had some real reactions to that kind of label of bisexual at the end of it. I hasten to admit, I'm kind of a little embarrassed to admit this, but my first one of my first reactions after finishing it was I thought it would be gayer, you know.
I think that's valid.
It occurred to me how woefully inaccurate some of these labels are. You know, I would probably define, it's not up to me to define Charles Blow, and it's not up to Charles Blow to be gay for my sake, you know, but I would probably define him based on the way he kind of loosely defines himself in this book as mostly straight. And it really kind of made me look at my own self and my own feelings about social justice and this community and intersectionality. And I thought, gosh, Eric, who are you to define who's gay enough to be part of this rainbow, right? I mean, you know, certainly my feeling, you know, and my stated conscious value, which remains constant, is that he absolutely belongs in this conversation. And yet my emotional reaction to this was, you know, this guy's mostly straight. And I just had some stuff that I had to wrestle with about that.
Eric, I have to admit, and then I want to get Kent and Rashawn's opinions too. I had the same reaction because I was in a gay men's book club, the only woman, the only lesbian for a year, and they would have been disappointed because they would have said, what? This guy is not gay. But you're right about the labels, because one reason I added that line about we're doing the B in LGBT is I realized this time, and it hadn't hit me in the first reading, as I read the last pages, I thought, wow, possibly to the majority of lesbians, I'm bisexual, because I was in a very happy marriage with my son's dad, and I loved him for 17 and a half years, and we're still friends. I consider myself a lesbian, but to many other lesbians, I would be bisexual. And so what you said about labels is absolutely true. Rashawn?
Well, I think it says something, too, about self-determination and self-agency that you get to decide, and it's for others to do, as Eric said, to wrestle with it within themselves however they need to arrive at a place of acceptance. But one of the things that I will say about Blow is that, and I've had this conversation a lot among my friends, and I've wrestled with it, too, personally, not because I didn't believe him, but because it was almost like, well, you didn't finish the journey. Like, you know, bi is just a stop on the way to gay, you know, so as so many of us think of it, unfortunately. But he seems to really occupy that space well. He's not, I didn't feel like it was foreboding. I didn't feel like he was trying to convince us of anything, trying to sell or force his straightness or his, you know, his heterosexual attractions. He genuinely is who he is, and he owns that space. But it does say something about how we within the LGBTQIA rainbow.
And there's other letters.
There are. I'm just going to, you know, I just call them the ABC sometimes. That's what I do with us. Sorry, family. But I think that we have got to get to a point where a person's choice is what we're accepting, not what we see, think, or feel about them.
Exactly. Kent, any thoughts?
Well, I couldn't agree more with how Rashawn just summed that up. I had much the same kind of struggle, I think, that Eric did. And it was in talking through it with a couple of friends last night, you know, for Friday night drinks, and it occurred to me that my reaction or my understanding of myself after reading and accepting Blow's understanding of himself is how very B maybe we all are. You know, I was talking with a friend who was interested enough in having sex with women that he tried it out in college, and that was his step on the way to gay, as you said. And for me, I've only recently realized that I might be intrigued to do that. So being really G has been my journey to maybe realizing how B I am. It really is an individual experience. And to try to fit them into neat boxes is silly, and it reduces our rejoicing in how complicated and different we really all are from each other.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. But if I could just jump in on that one point, I think that, and I'm fairly certain as I was rereading, Blow used this word, but fluid. And I think that that word probably is where we need to be, because it allows us to explore all the little nooks and crannies of ourselves and to sway between. But I think it's once we detach ourselves from these expectations that we place upon ourselves, or that we allow others to place upon us, like so many heavy yokes around our necks.
And I think one advantage we have being LGBT is that we at least have met others who are not like us, most of us. And in looking at reviews, there were some people who had a strong reaction to this book. One man called it trash, utter trash. And I just thought, I think you just said more about yourself than you
right.
did Charles
right.
M. Blow. Another woman said that everywhere she went, this is about 2014, she saw people reading it on the New York subway. And it became its own little book club, because people would see the book and start talking about it. And I think, and Erica, I'll turn it to you next, it does evoke strong emotions, and it does make you look within.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think that part of that is his own ability to look within. And so many things, you know, and to me, I did read one review on Amazon. I believe it was on Amazon, where someone said, you know, it was really great at the beginning, and then they got to this horrible thing later on about the hazing in college. And I have to say that that was probably the most affecting part of the entire book for me, was this description of growing up, having been abused, having that abuse have a real detrimental effect on his psyche, and then finding himself at this college where he goes through a just awful, I was never part of a fraternity, so this was all very, very new to me, this you know, routine of hazing people in order to create some kind of group cohesion that just seemed sadistic to me. And then being thrust into the leadership of this organization and being in charge of overseeing this kind of abuse, and how he had to wrestle within himself to come to a conclusion around, you know, well, this is tradition and everyone thinks it's a great idea, but I certainly had problems with it when I went through it myself. And what is really the point here? And that struggle where he comes out on the other side and says, you know, in order to be a complete human being, I really have to take a stand where my values are. And I have to first, you know, like all of us do, discover where those values are. Those don't come pre-printed for us. You know, we have to wrestle with ourselves to figure out where we stand. And coming from someone who had experienced abuse himself, obviously he had a different, perhaps, vantage point than some of the other boys. We have to remember these are all boys who were doing this, even though they feel like big, scary men when you read about it. So yeah, I mean, I think you'd have to be a special kind of egotist to put this down and not have to think for yourself a little bit. You know, have I done that? Where have I done that? Where is my own struggle around living according to my values? And where am I willing to bend my values a little bit to get along? And where am I going to be rock solid in who I am?
Well, jump ahead. That actually was one of the questions I had, but I want to go with that. Was the hazing section too big a part of the book? And I'll ask you first, Rashawn. I think that it does startle some readers. They're expecting to read about college, of course, but then move on to maybe family and career. And the hazing is a major portion of this book and certainly memorable.
I felt like it was proportional to the impact that they had on his life, both then and since. And so to me, it wasn't too much a part of the book. I mean, it's very graphic, but it's also very honest. As we were discussing earlier in the green room, there is a new Netflix TV series out called Burning Sands. And it is about, you know, these fraternities and sororities, the hazing that takes place, particularly among a lot of what are known as the Divine Nine, the Black Greek organizations. And it needs to be shared and shown. So maybe it had a different sort of resonance with me. And I know the impact that it has had on so many of my friends. And so maybe I took a little bit different take on it. But it seems to me that it was proportional to the impact that it had in his life. And so, no, it wasn't too big a part of the book. Although I think there probably were some readers who expected a little bit more of the, I don't know if I would say the flourish, but I felt like it was so true. Like, how could you not want to know more about that?
Well, I have strong opinions on this. I think I indicated to you. But, Kent, what about you?
I mean, it certainly, that was an experience that had a huge impact on him and led to a real watershed moment. And I understand his need to explore it and to reveal as much of it as he did. I felt that it's the length of that section came at the cost of understanding other things about his college experience that we only kind of catch up on quickly as he gets out of it. I wanted to know a little bit more about his intellectual growth. Aside from the experience of the fraternity, how did being at an all-black college shape his values? Did it give him the experience that he thought he was going to have? And I felt like he lost the chance to answer some of those questions by dwelling so at such great length on the hazing.
That's interesting. The first time through, I will admit, I read it early this year, and I thought, wow, this section's too long. And this time, I spent more time contemplating why he did it, and I realized that I had kind of buried a memory that was very painful from my college. It was a Presbyterian college, very, very, very conservative. It still is. It's usually in the top five conservative colleges, mostly white, but fraternities and sororities were very, very big. I was not in a sorority. I was not accepted, and it destroyed me till I realized I didn't want to be in one. But the fraternities basically ran that school, and I'm going to read an item. It was Grove City College and the Adelphi Coast Fraternity. I remember I taught as a senior. I had a freshman class that I was responsible for. One of my students died, and the way I learned this was 17 pledges were taken on a drop-off, and that's where there's no lights. They're on a rural road. Four were killed by a car. The driver had fallen asleep at the wheel. The dead were Thomas Morgan Elliott, John Curtin, Rudolph Meehan, and Gary Gilliland, all 18. Was alcohol a factor? Unknown. Most accounts say the driver fell asleep at the wheel. He slammed into the pledges, and four died. The hazing at Grove City was brutal. There were these paddlings. I don't know if they were, I wasn't in a fraternity, I don't know if they were as bad as he described, but I do know that they used sleep deprivation, and they would make them stay up for days and days, and I was in plays, and we would take some of the pledges and say, don't rehearse, just go take a nap. And then we would guard the door to make sure that none of the brothers saw them. Even though I knew about it to have experienced that, I now know in rereading, it would have been a huge chapter.
And I guess I can agree that it's a lengthy section, but I didn't feel like it was gratuitous. And I think that would have probably made me a little bit irritated with him if I felt like you were just adding this in to fill pages or to, you know, have some, to sensationalize it in some way. But it felt like it was, you know, it was relevant, even though I can concede with you all that it was a lengthy portion.
We're going to play a song.
So much that I've been through, no, I'm not the only one. All that I can do is hope and pray my time will come. I never went to college, though I never had regrets. These days I know that knowledge won't be writing me a check. Unemployment compensation cannot pay.
This is Elizabeth Anderson. This is the Sandra Moran Radio Book Club. We're discussing Charles M. Blow's Fire Shut Up in My Bones. And I am joined by Rashawn Gilmore, Eric Peterson, and Kent Cozad. I want to know what you thought of the setting, the small towns in Louisiana and his family. What struck you about either of those? Eric?
I have to say the image that probably sticks out most in my mind as I think back to his description of the small town was that chain link fence in the middle of the cemetery. The idea that people are segregated even until after, you know, even after they're dead. In some of the later reviews that I read after I finished the book, people described the small town as a place that the civil rights movement kind of missed. And that seemed apt to me. Reading it as a white man and reading about this black family, those instances where racism was depicted, but again, as I said before, as a journalist, just kind of here are the facts, here are some of the things that I grew up with, and I was left to kind of let the emotional weight of that kind of hang on me. And the other thing was this character, who of course isn't a character, is a real person, but the way he characterizes his mother in this book is, I just think, so wonderful. I mean, she's got so many facets between the brass knuckles and the pistol in her drawer and that scene where she runs, you know, she tells him to go get my gun so I can run after this woman who's flirting with my husband, who showed up to my house, and this is a step too far, and then stops herself, which of course, if this were a novel, I would say that was such perfect foreshadowing to his own journey a little bit later on. But, you know, and maybe it was, just because life sometimes emulates art in some of the best ways. But those are the things that really struck me. The setting, in terms of the way that race was just hinted at, because he didn't really know a whole lot of white people. The only white character I really remember is that teacher who sent him off to the slow class when he really, he deserved to be in the gifted courses, and he really experienced that when he had some African-American teachers. But the way that race was depicted in a way that just, they're just descriptive, just not embellished, but so evocative. And then this woman, this towering figure, his mom, who's just so wonderfully rich and complicated, even given his very journalistic style. Those really grabbed me.
I could see his mother played in a film by Alfre Woodard or Viola Davis. I think either of those could do that scene. Kent, what about you?
I want to jump off from what Eric was talking about beautifully and with so much love that Blow puts to describing his mother and telling her story through telling his story. I thought that was terrific. And what really touched me about his description of family was at the end of the book, actually, when he talks about towards the end where his parents are now and their journey with each other, where he writes that theirs was a relationship that was afflicted in youth and has become cured by age. As their kindness to each other grew in the shadow of bad memories, they demonstrated the resilience of love, the power of forgiveness, and the possibility of moving forward and growing in grace. And he has a love for his family that even as he describes difficult moments with his family, it's palpable and it's there through the early sections. I was really impressed, and also impressed with the clarity he gave to a child's experience of poverty. And there it's where I think his journalistic style really helped. It wasn't maudlin, it was matter of fact. And to have those experiences as just matter of fact, have that in your face as you read, I think is important for us. I didn't grow up in the best of material circumstances, but certainly not as impoverished as he and his family were at times, and I was very moved by that.
Rashawn?
It was resonant because it was familiar. Not exactly to, point by point from my own upbringing, but from stories that I have heard from my relatives and older friends who grew up in places like Louisiana, in these really, really small towns. And it's almost as if, and I think maybe Eric said this, that the civil rights movement hadn't quite reached there yet. And so in some ways they were very isolated, made going off to college such a huge thing for him. But the figure, or two figures from his family that stood out most to me were, and he does a beautiful job in talking about his mother. Like, I felt like I knew that woman. Like, she's like every auntie and my own mother, right? But it was really his Aunt Trudy, the great aunt Trudy, who... It was this. He describes her at one point as a wig splitter, or as my grandfather would say, she's a skull cracker. Like, you don't want to fight her; she'll crack your skull open. And so here she was, this very strong and towering figure, who once showed up at the laundromat where the woman who had been cheating with her husband was washing clothes with his mother. And I don't know if his mother called her; she just knew she was there. And he was Blow was in the car playing "Mom's Inside," and Aunt Trudy shows up, and she's got her gun, and she's waving it, and she's pointing it, and she's threatening this woman to come outside, because she cheated, and took her man. And so for as strong as she is, and it's juxtaposed against her very frailty and how the wind, the life was sucked out of her when her son, his cousin, Lawrence, was murdered. And so at some point in the broadcast, I've got a passage that I want to read that is just so eloquent about how he describes her transition, but also who Lawrence was as this young gay man in this small, small town in Louisiana.
If you want to read it now.
I will gladly take the opportunity. So I'm going to, the chapter titled "The Punk Next Door," so that gives you a hint of where we're going. But not Lawrence. He wouldn't pretend. He wouldn't hide. And that is what people found repulsive. It was what they saw as his surrender to a lurid impulse, his embrace of an ignoble identity, the scent of a demon on his breath. Dangerous. I would be grown before I recognized how much courage it must have taken for Lawrence to live as he did, outside the rules and ahead of his time, in such a small place. But not every man was like the shopkeeper. One day, more than a decade later, the danger of Lawrence's life would catch up to him. He would be found murdered in a neighboring town, tied to a bed. Although I didn't know anyone in Gippsland who had ever seen him with a man, not in a romantic way, many folks assumed that some of the men who scoffed at him by day played around with him at night. The gossip was that it was one of those men who killed Lawrence. But no one knew who did it, and few other than his family, particularly Aunt Trudy, really seemed to want to know. His death reduced her bark to a whimper and shook her faith. I don't know why God let that happen to Lawrence. I just can't pray right no more. My heart hurt for her. How could this have happened to Lawrence, the most harmless and most isolated of men? And why weren't more people upset and unsettled? People whispered, but no one protested. The sense of scandal seemed to outweigh the sense of outrage. Yet everyone went to the funeral. Many, no doubt, see a strange man turned up who looked up, who cried too hard, a distraught lover or a guilty one. The unspoken message was sent with the horrible and mistakable truth. Black men who lived their lives as Lawrence had lived his would not be valued for life or death. The world that had judged Lawrence's honest life as dishonorable would in fact conduct life dishonorably. A few people were questioned in Lawrence's murder, but no one was arrested, and soon the whole thing faded away. 5 years later, Lawrence was tied to the bed and killed. Matthew Shepard, a young, white, openly gay man, was tied to a fence and killed in a small Wyoming city. While Lawrence's death hardly made the local papers, Matthew's provoked an international outcry. That discrepancy would haunt me. And I think it's in those echoes. We talk about the geography and the isolation of the small town, but then also the juxtaposition of Aunt Trudy being this towering figure, but also at once faint and weakened by the death of Lawrence. And then again, of course, Lawrence's death juxtaposed against that of Matthew Shepard, and how the intersectionality comes in. And just 5 years later, so it wasn't like two different era. It's just amazing to me.
And this book was written a few years ago. And certainly young black lives being lost are very much in the news right now.
Oh, absolutely.
And I thought that was a very moving passage.
Well, just a sidebar to that, you know, there was, I'm sure some of you may remember, but just a couple of years ago, Charles's son, a student at Yale University, was stopped by the campus police force and really was harassed by them. They were looking for a suspect in a crime or a suspicious character, whatever, and how he was treated, this young black man. And I think for Charles realizing, maybe like with Lawrence, there was nothing he could have done about it for either Lawrence or his son. And the gravity of that moment of feeling defenseless, but realizing that these same incidents still happen all these years later.
One question I had about his family, you mentioned Aunt Trudy and Lawrence, is this is a big family.
Yes.
And there are a lot of marriages, and I kept having to go back and see, okay,
connections.
Yeah, who's Joe, who's Jed, who's Grandma? Did anybody else have that problem? I think part of it is me, because I was in a nuclear family of five. And I knew a few aunts and uncles and cousins, but there was no divorce, and so it was very easy to keep track of people. Did you have any trouble following this really interwoven family, Eric?
I did, and similar to you, Elizabeth, I actually grew up not only in a nuclear family, but a military family, so I was often overseas, and it was just my sister and I and my parents, and that was really kind of my close family. My entire family of origin, the extended family, were all seemingly in Lewiston, Idaho, and there was not a whole lot of divorce there either. So yeah, the goings on. But what also kind of struck me, I think along the same vein, if I'm not turning too much of a corner, was the fact that even among his brothers, the older brothers, seemed to be this kind of amorphous group that didn't really include him. And I never really, it struck me that as well as I got to know his mother, and as well as we got to know figures like Aunt Trudy and his father and some of the other, you know, principal figures, you know, his brothers just seemed to kind of all meld together for me. They didn't, he didn't spend a lot of time distinguishing their personalities either. And so when they were mentioned, I had a hard time sorting out which was which. And then it kind of occurred to me that maybe it didn't matter, because I wasn't going to need to know that really to understand his story, and how even though he was in such a big family, even his nuclear family was what I would call a big family, he was still so often so isolated and alone. Really struck me.
Good point. Kent?
It was a little difficult for me to keep track of the relationships, and I'm glad, Eric, that you mentioned the lack of specificity about the brothers, because that was the group who was the most confusing to me. That not being able to keep straight in my head all of the adult relationships that were very complicated didn't bother me nearly as much, because I sort of felt like I was being invited into the life of a friend, where you can't quite keep the details straight. But if you listen long enough, you have those aha moments like, oh, I do know who this person is. But the brothers, I couldn't even keep track of what their age difference was from him at times. I wanted to know more.
I thought, Eric, your point about his being isolated in spite of being in such a big family, was important. And the title of the book, Fire Shut Up in My Bones, one reviewer referred to it as a Jeremiad, which I thought was interesting.
Well, you know, you'd asked earlier before the break about, you talked about the lady who said that she has seen folks on the subway reading. I think what's so compelling about the book initially for me was the title. And Jeremiah, of course, being one of the so-called weeping prophets, he was known as a complainer. But there's something about this title and that brings the book sort of full circle to me, which is that he could not contain who he really was. And so this whole book was this evidencing of that truth, that he was growing into that and that he was just putting it out before. So most of us who come from a spiritual or particularly a Pentecostal tradition, you say the fire shut up in my bones. That means the Holy Ghost is moving. And so, you know, whatever's in you is going to come out. And I think that's so profound for him.
Eric?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. When I heard the title, I guess, it, just like I, one of my initial responses was, gee, I expected it to be gayer. I expected it to be fierier. You know?
It's just not gay enough for Eric.
It was sad. You know, there was just so much, you know, isolation there. And you know, the result of this one episode of abuse from his older cousin just really cut his spirit off from the rest of his body, and he was just kind of a walking shell. It seemed like for a really long time. And in that episode, I remember kind of thinking, you know, I put the book down and I saw the cover and I thought, Charles, where's the fire? Like, I'm not seeing a lot of it. And yet, you know, I do understand what Rashad is saying in terms of what it really means is there's this thing inside of you and it won't go away. You know, who you are is who you are. And so much of that is born into you. And it kind of, you know, in terms of sexuality, you know, it did come out. And maybe some of the reasons why I was expecting the book to be quote unquote gayer as it went along is all of these references to people criticizing the way he walked or the way he held himself, that it was too girly, that something, you know, that people could see this little sexual deviant in there. And that was such a common story for me. I remember growing up, so much mental energy was spent trying to control my body, do not let that come out, even though I was convinced that I was heterosexual until I was well into adulthood, also having to do with some of those messages I received. And I wondered if that was, rather than fire, I was kind of thinking maybe a little glitter, but if that was part of what was going on there as well.
Kent?
Oh, Eric, you're just so right about that being singled out for the way he walked. I mean, it brought back a memory that I hadn't had for many, 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 many years, and it was a summer evening when I was, you know, verbally abused and bullied by a group of the neighborhood boys because of the way I walked and because of the way I kept pushing my hair out of my face as they were trying to intimidate me. And I stood my ground, not so much out of the conviction that I was right or that I was being brave, but I was too frightened to turn my back on them and run into the house. It was disconcerting to have that memory again and to realize how difficult so many moments in my early childhood really were.
One thought I had about the title was fire can reduce you to ashes, or you can rise like a phoenix. And I thought it forged him. I thought he became stronger. And Eric, I agree with you what you said about it had been in him. It was burning inside. I think that he was going to make it through because he had that in him. And I don't know why some people do and some don't.
That's an interesting point. I think that it reminds me of that saying or proverb or scripture, whatever it is, that many are called but few are chosen. And one of the things that I know about Charles Blow is that whether it is in a tweet or a column or this memoir, his goal, especially in this memoir, his goal is to make sure that he gives words to those who don't have them. And I think that's what he wanted to accomplish with this book. And I think that's why he has that fire, Elizabeth, because he has a responsibility to give words and voice for others who don't have it, who can't do it, and to empower them using his the platforms that he has. And so that may be why he had that fire and why we get to experience it with him by virtue of his sharing it in the book.
You had mentioned early on, Rashawn, authenticity. He is. And authenticity frequently requires acknowledging the gray areas, the ambiguities. And for me, one of those moments was the lie detector test when he was thinking about going to the CIA. Eric, any thoughts on that?
Oh, that was horrible. I just horrible in a really good way. I mean, you know, really very troubling to read. And so if I could give a little bit of spoilers for those who haven't read the book, kind of what happens there in the lie detector test is that he is being recruited by the CIA, and they give him a lie detector test, and one of the questions is, have you ever had sex with a man? And he says no, and it immediately starts firing off, like, you're telling a lie, you're telling a lie. And so he tells this person who is administering this test, well, here's the deal. I was abused sexually by a cousin of mine. It wasn't something that I wanted to do, and so that's why I answered the way that I did. Can I take it again? And they said yes. And so when they ask him the same question again, have you ever had sex with a man? He says yes, and it's still telling him that he's lying. And so just the injustice of that question, of course, is one of the things that is really called to mind. It's like, you know, what does it matter? And obviously, I think in the early days when they were, you know, they don't ask that question anymore. But when they were, it was a sense of, you know, can you be blackmailed? So they wanted to make sure that all this stuff was on the table so that anybody who was gay wouldn't then be, you know, blackmailed into selling secrets, government secrets, to some kind of foreign power because of that. But where does abuse fall into that? And just trying to make the pieces fit. It's something that he really wanted and then was just denied him because no matter what he did or how hard he tried to tell the truth, something about it was a lie because it just couldn't be understood by people who had a completely different agenda. It's such a tragedy and such a small thing that obviously, if he had been recruited into the CIA, you know, he might not have ever written this book, and we probably wouldn't know him as the wonderful writer that he is. But his life would have taken a completely different turn, and that was his destiny to forge, and that was really taken away from him. It was a very tragic, small, and again, just, you know, here are the facts, here's what happened, but just tragic to read that.
Kent, anything to add?
Not really, other than I recall feeling just so, I felt powerless with him in that situation, because, whereas Eric just described it, there was no true answer then to that question, and I didn't know what to make of it, and I got the feeling it's almost like he didn't know what to make of it at the time.
I would agree with you. I think he didn't. Eric, you mentioned the road not taken. If he had gone into the CIA, would we even have this book? Where would he be? In the prologue, this isn't a spoiler because it's the prologue, he's hurtling down a road with a loaded gun, and he's going to go in search of Cousin Chester, and he's going to blow him away. And certainly if he had done that, that would have been a completely different path that probably would have involved prison or death. But did that ring true that he made the decision he did? Obviously, he wrote the book. He didn't do it. What did you think of this road not taken? Why? I mean, he was in a white-hot fury.
Okay, so this is where I might part ways with my co-panelists today. I did feel that when he was so angry and he's got the gun, he's going to go kill his guy. I felt like that was just a tinge melodramatic for me.
What?
And perhaps because even knowing what I do know about Charles Blow, I just can't see it. So maybe I had that disconnect, even though he was very angry. He's, what, 20 years old now, and he's, like, ready to exact his revenge. But
I've seen melodrama on your Facebook page.
I'm probably the queen of melodrama. So maybe I'm projecting a little bit.
You know, Rashawn, this is Eric. I don't disagree with you here. For all of my effusive praise about his journalistic style, I will admit to you that when I got to the part of the book where we came back to that episode, I'd forgotten. I'd forgotten the prologue was even there. I mean, the prologue was certainly written in such a way. It's meant, I think, to grab your attention and really kind of suck you in. But to me, the idea probably would have been, I think what Blow maybe wanted us to do was, as we went through some of the more sad and somber moments of his childhood, we're thinking to ourselves, when does the gun thing happen? Like, when are we going to get there? And it was the furthest thing from my mind.
Yep.
Honestly, if I had read this as a first draft and Blow had asked me for any kind of feedback, I might have just said, you know what, you can lose the prologue. It just doesn't. I mean, I found the stories of his childhood to be compelling enough without that. And the fact that he once grabbed a gun and contemplated killing Cousin Chester, it shows how harrowing that moment of abuse was for him and how it affected him years and years later. And without getting into my own story too much, I have a similar experience in my life that there was a very isolated incident of what I would call sexual abuse in my childhood. And it does haunt you for a long, long time. It's amazing how, you know, 10 minutes of your life as a 5-year-old can just not go away. So I get that. And I, you know, that, so it didn't seem melodramatic from that standpoint. But just in terms of literary structure, I might have told him to lose it because it didn't. It's not what kept me involved.
And Kent, do you agree?
I agree completely with my colleagues. I have no reason to doubt the authenticity of the story, but in the long run, it didn't contribute to my understanding his character any better than the description of the abuse itself and the sense of how it continued to impact a lot of his decisions and the way he comported himself through his entire life. I didn't need the setup of the gun at the beginning.
I would agree, and Roshan knows that I have on occasion contradicted myself, so I'm going to disagree with myself here. I said he didn't leave anything out, but I think he did, because in an interview he talked about bullying and extreme bullying, and I think that after the moment of abuse that's in the book, he was bullied by Chester, and there were allusions to it. I think that's probably the portion that was left out that led to the loaded gun and his driving down the road.
And that might have helped to make that connection. Mm-hmm. I can see that. But a couple pieces of this book where we don't get a lot of depth are things that I think we end up, as LGBTQ people, taking in stride a lot of times. The bullying, the suffering, you know, the abuse. And so we oftentimes, even in relaying our stories to others, we don't even explore those depths because it's just part of what is expected or what is twisted but normal in some ways. And I think that there was that buildup and maybe having that link between what happened with Cousin Chester at age 7 and then him wanting to do something about it finally at age 20, maybe understanding that level in depth. Because really, it's an act of violence every time thereafter that Cousin Chester shows up in any space where he is, right? So that violence is relived over and over and over repeatedly, but not only the violence of it, the suffering and the silence. And so more along that line would have really been just the perfect linkage for me.
I think, too, this is where gender roles come into play, because as a lesbian, I don't recall really ever being bullied because I didn't have a gay voice and I didn't have a gay walk. You're allowed more latitude. I have butch friends who were bullied because they weren't feminine enough for expected roles. But we're starting to run out of time, so I'm going to ask Eric and Kent any last thoughts about the book. And I really appreciate your being on the show today. Eric?
Well, thank you, first of all, for inviting me. This has been a real pleasure. And Kent and Roshan, even though I can't see you, and I can't see you either, Elizabeth, I thank you so much for inviting me here. I guess the only thing I have to say that wasn't already in my mind was just highly recommended. You know, if you're listening to this and you haven't read the book, you know, it's an easy read in the sense of, you know, you don't have to think too hard, and it is one of those that you look up and it, you know, an hour has passed by and you're like, where did that hour go? And you realize that you've just devoured 75 pages. And yet it does take you on an emotional journey and gives you a lot to think about when you're done. It's not just some story that sits apart from you, that doesn't give you a lot to question. So I always appreciate that in the works that I read. So, you know, have already recommended this to several of my friends and will do so to anyone who asks.
Thank you. Kent?
Well, thank you, Elizabeth, for inviting me. The discussion has been so much better than I even imagined, and it was really terrific to have an opportunity to read something I hadn't read before and might not ever have actually gotten around to picking up, as much as I like Blow's writing in the Times as a columnist. And it was a pleasure to once again read with a lot of careful